From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the infighting among the Pentagon, State Department, and White House about the intelligence that was used to make the case for war and about how to best plan for post-war Iraq. We talk with journalist Martin Smith. He's the reporter and co-producer of Truth, War, and Consequences, which kicks off the new season of the PBS investigative series Frontline. Also, we talk with actress Sarah Polley. The 24-year-old has been acting since the age of 6. Her films include Exotica, The Sweet Hair After, and Go. In the new film, My Life Without Me, she plays a young wife and mother who learns she's about to die, but keeps it a secret. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There was more violence today in the Iraqi capital. 3 separate attacks left 12 people dead, a Spanish diplomat, an American soldier, and 10 Iraqis. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Baghdad.
The attacks began early in the morning when Spanish military attaché José Antonio Bernal was chased barefoot down the street and shot by 3 men, one dressed as a Muslim cleric. A few hours later, while Iraqi police officers waited to collect their weekly salaries, 2 men rammed the front gates of the station and exploded a bomb. 2 officers died and 8 civilians. In the chaos of the carnage, it is still not clear how many Iraqis were injured. An American soldier died northeast of the city after a rocket-propelled grenade hit his convoy. And in western Iraq, near the Syrian border, American soldiers captured a top military officer from Saddam's regime, who they believe is a financier for anti-American operations. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Baghdad.
President Bush told military personnel in New Hampshire today that the attacks on U.S. troops and others in Iraq will not break American resolve to bring stability to the country. He also defended his decision to attack Saddam Hussein.
I acted because I was not about to leave the security of the American people in the hands of a madman. I was not about to stand by and wait and trust in the sanity and restraint of Saddam Hussein.
In another New Hampshire appearance, the president said the U.S. economy is getting stronger. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president's New Hampshire visit is part of an effort by the administration to reverse declining public support for the president's job performance. On the economy, Mr. Bush said the tax cuts he has backed will lead to a turnaround, and he pointed to a number of items he says demonstrate that.
Last month, the economy exceeded expectations and added net new jobs. Inflation is low. After-tax incomes are rising. Home ownership is at record levels. Productivity is high, and it is rising.
The president's visit to New Hampshire also felt a bit like a campaign stop. This is the site of the first major presidential primary in late January, and Mr. Bush squeezed in an impromptu visit to a local pizza parlor in Manchester to shake some hands. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
The 9 candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination are preparing to debate tonight in Phoenix, Arizona. It's the first debate for the Democrats since Senator Bob Graham of Florida dropped out last week. The 90-minute debate is scheduled to be broadcast live on CNN in an hour. In stocks today, the Dow gained 49 points to close at 9,680. The Nasdaq was up 18 to close at 1911. This is NPR News. The Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, has cleaned out its closets and donated more than 60 artifacts from the home of Albert Einstein to the Princeton Historical Society. Aries Keck reports from member station WHYY in Philadelphia.
Almost all of the items from Albert Einstein's home, a grandfather clock, chairs, end tables, and a bed, were smuggled out of Nazi Germany by Einstein when he came to Princeton in 1933. Princeton Historical Society director Gail Stern says one of her favorite pieces is Einstein's music stand.
Everyone knows that he was a great physicist, but I don't think everyone knows his love of music and how that kind of inspired him in his research and his theoretical work.
The music stand and one of Einstein's many pipes are already on display at the Society's small museum. The other pieces are being restored, and the Princeton Historical Society hopes to recreate Einstein's interiors for a permanent display. For NPR News, I'm Aries Keck in Philadelphia.
The Associated Press says that Teamsters union members have voted overwhelmingly today to accept a new contract with Chicago area's private trash haulers, ending a 9-day garbage collector strike. In Philadelphia, Philadelphia Mayor John Street called on the FBI today to tell who was targeted by electronic eavesdropping equipment that was found in the mayor's office suite. Street, who's fighting for re-election, said the FBI should lift the clouds over City Hall by explaining the purpose of the investigation. A day after hidden microphones were found in the mayor's office, the FBI raided a business that received a no-bid contract from the city in 2002. FBI officials declined comment about the surveillance of the mayor's office. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Radio Shack, featuring the new Radio Shack MasterCard credit card. Details in stores. Radio Shack. You've got questions, we've got answers.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Truth, War, and Consequences is the title of the report on the season premiere of the PBS investigative series Frontline. It's about the infighting among the Pentagon, State Department, and White House over the intelligence that was used to make the case for war in Iraq and the planning that was done to create an orderly post-war transition. My guest Martin Smith is the reporter and co-producer of this edition. He's made several Frontline documentaries that have focused on terrorism, including The Terrorist and the Superpower, In Search of Al-Qaeda, and Hunting Bin Laden. His Frontline documentary, Truth, War, and Consequences, airs tonight on most PBS stations. One of the people you interviewed for the show is Ahmed Chalabi, who was a major source for the Pentagon in its pre- and post-war planning. Just tell us briefly who Ahmed Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress, which he was part of, who they are.
The Iraqi National Congress was founded in 1992 in the wake of the first Gulf War, founded by Dr. Ahmed Chalabi, who comes from a banking background. And he has probably done more to bring about the fall of Saddam Hussein than any other person besides George Bush. Civilians in the Pentagon have been enthralled with him. He's at the same time a very divisive figure, a controversial figure, who many in the State Department and the CIA revile. That's not too strong a word, given the kind of controversy that he stirs up in Washington.
What kind of information did he give the Pentagon that the Pentagon used to make its case for invading Iraq?
He provided defectors. He actually received money from the U.S. government, and he used that money to attract and pay defectors. Now, he has said that he has only provided 3 defectors, but if you talk to people in the intelligence community, it's much more than that. And his organization, if it wasn't Ahmed Chalabi himself providing the defector, has also provided information and defectors. So Richard Perle, the Defense Department advisor, told the New York Times that Ahmed Chalabi was, I think the quote is, without question, the single best source of intelligence the U.S. government had on Iraq.
What was Chalabi telling the Pentagon about weapons of mass destruction?
Well, he was making a case all along that Saddam Hussein had current and active programs. And the problem here is that Iraq was a black box. It wasn't well penetrated by our intelligence services, so we relied on defectors. And people in the intelligence agencies will tell you that defectors are a risky bet because they have other motivations. And these guys were getting money. They also knew that their bread was buttered by the INC. The INC had a political interest in seeing Saddam fall, and so the defectors knew that if they brought information that the INC wanted to hear, it would be well received.
If the Pentagon trusted Ahmed Chalabi and the INC as a source, how come the State Department did not?
The State Department was dubious about the idea of backing any single Iraqi exile. The idea that the State Department had was that we should move into Iraq and allow Iraqi exiles to come back home and to let Iraqis in the country organize themselves politically and not come in with a preordained backing an Iraqi exile group from the get-go. So it wasn't so much that they all distrusted Chalabi, although there were those that did. They'd had some bad experiences in the middle of the 90s in which they had backed Chalabi. He'd received CIA contacts and money, and he was running some operations in Iraq to try to get an uprising going. And he provided intelligence to the CIA and the State Department that was deemed shoddy. The depth and breadth of his support was deemed not what he was claiming it to be, and that soured many people in the State Department on what this guy represented.
Another source of disagreement between different branches of the Bush administration was the weapons of mass destruction. Was there definitive evidence of weapons of mass destruction? Where did the Pentagon stand on that?
Well, the civilians in the Pentagon believed that there was enough evidence. They had felt that the CIA, the DIA, were biased, that they didn't evaluate the intelligence of weapons of mass destruction or the evidence of links with al-Qaeda, between al-Qaeda and Saddam, fairly. They thought that the CIA had biases against believing that al-Qaeda and Saddam could work together. So they formed their own small intelligence unit in order to essentially second-guess the intelligence that was coming out of the CIA and the other agencies.
And what did they find with this Special Intelligence Office?
Well, the Special Intelligence Office is a bit of a secret. We don't know exactly what they found. We do have some information that they were looking over the intelligence that existed and reevaluating it and sending it back up the to policymakers. Much of it was apparently intelligence that had been ignored or discredited, and they pulled this back out of the file and say, "Hey, wait a minute, look at this." One example of that was reports of meetings between the 9/11 hijacker Mohammed Atta and an Iraqi intelligence officer in Prague. This got into comments that the vice president would make on Meet the Press. This was information that had been discredited by the FBI. They determined that Atta could not have been in Prague when those supposed meetings took place. But yet this would live on, and this would continue to be repeated by the vice president. This was the kind of thing that the Special Intelligence Office would take a look at and say, wait a minute, we think this could have happened. We think this is good evidence. And so they would ship it on.
Now, you interviewed Ahmet Chalabi for your report, Truth, War, and Consequences. And you asked him about his claim that he had evidence that there were links between Iraq and al-Qaeda. What did he tell you?
It was an interesting exchange that I had with Ahmet Chalabi. I'd met him in 98. Because at that time, after the African embassy bombings, I was investigating al-Qaeda at that time, and I met with Ahmet Chalabi because he was making claims about al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein then. And I asked him again about that in the program, and he said, indeed, he had lots of evidence that there were links. And I said, do you have any documentary evidence of any kind? He says, yeah, there's such a document. And I said, well, I'd like to see that. That's important. In fact, that's a reason we went to war. One of the major explanations for why we needed to go after Saddam Hussein. And he then sort of twisted and did promise finally to show me the document, but then never was able to do so. He's now said that he can't find it. It's a kind of dog ate my homework excuse, which I can't quite buy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Smith, and his report, Truth, War, and Consequences, will be broadcast tonight on most PBS stations as part of the Frontline series. Another subject that you investigate in Truth, War, and Consequences is the planning that went on within the Bush administration for what would happen in Iraq after the invasion. The State Department had created something called the Future of Iraq Project, and this was created before the invasion of Iraq. What was the goal of this project?
The Future of Iraq Project was the idea behind it was to draw on the Iraqi exile community, engage Iraqis in thinking hard about the problems that a post-war Iraq was going to face. This ranged from, you know, how to keep law and order on the streets to how to keep the water and electricity flowing after the war. I mean, all of these very important questions that we failed really to address in the post-war period, in the immediate post-war period, and still struggling to address them. So they engaged about 200 to 300 Iraqis in about 15 different working groups, all looking at various aspects of post-war Iraq.
And what did they recommend?
Well, the problem with the Future of Iraq project is that there was no head to the to this thing. I mean, it was a lot of seminars, a lot of talk, but there was no single synthesis of this material, because essentially the project got cut short. It got cut off before it could come to any kind of synthesis. So it's hard to say that there were any. In fact, many of the reports, and there were pages and pages of reports, were in Arabic and never got translated in such a way that an American official in Iraq could even read them.
My guest is Martin Smith. His documentary, Truth, War, and Consequences, airs tonight on most PBS stations on the investigative series Frontline. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Smith, and his report, Truth, War, and Consequences, will be broadcast tonight on the PBS series Frontline. We also interviewed members of the military, and some of them shared with you their frustrations that they were unequipped to help prevent looting and to keep order.
Well, they were unequipped to keep order. They hadn't had that kind of training. They aren't policemen. On the other hand, I talked to General Conway, who headed up the Marines, heads up the Marines there, and he said that they basically stood by for several days and watched the looting with a kind of passive attitude because they weren't told to do otherwise. This goes back to the Rosie scenario. We had an understanding. I mean, if you remember, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld talked about stuff happens. This is when you give people freedom; they're going to run wild a bit. And it was kind of an attitude that this wasn't such a big problem. The problem was that our concept of looting and their concept of looting were worlds apart, and the kind of looting that took place was so crushing to the infrastructure of the country that it set us back, far, far back.
So did members of the military who you interviewed tell you that they wish they had been given orders to stop the looting once it started?
Yeah, I found it almost exasperating talking to General Conway when I asked him about that, and he said that they had pretty much watched it with the attitude that it was something like a redistribution of, sort of a much-deserved redistribution of wealth. And I said, well, but as you realized, it was going further than that, and it was crushing the infrastructure. I said, did you get on the phone and call anybody and say, maybe we ought to stop this? And he says, no. Basically, he waited for orders, and the orders didn't come. We sat by, and we allowed this to go on.
In your Frontline story, several people you interview make the point how unprepared the United States was for the looting. But one person you interviewed talks about how he tried to convince the Bush administration to prepare for this because he'd seen it in other countries. What did he tell you?
This is Robert Perito, who works for the U.S. Institute for Peace, which is a government-sponsored think tank in Washington. He was invited by Richard Perle to come make a presentation. Perle had seen one of his monographs, his papers, and Perito was an expert on post-war situations. So he came to the Defense Policy Board in February 2003, just a month before the war really began. and said, based on his experience in studying post-war situations in Kosovo, Bosnia, East Timor, Haiti, Panama, in all of these situations, what was paramount was to have a police force on the ground operating immediately after the fall of the existing government to prevent looting and disorder and rampant crime. His presentation was to take 30 minutes. The Defense Policy Board, which meets just off the in a conference room right next to Secretary Rumsfeld's office, had him there for 90 minutes. They were very interested in what he had to say. He even was told that he was likely to come back. I couldn't talk to Richard Perle about this because Perle says that the discussions that take place at the policy board are off the table, off the record. But in any case, Perito did speak about it. He did make this presentation. But when he talked to the reconstruction team, they told him, well, they didn't really know what was going to go on after the war, so they were going to wait and see and then make recommendations later. Well, that proved fatal.
Another controversy that you look into in your frontline report is the issue of whether people who had been in the Ba'athist party, Saddam Hussein's party, should be allowed to participate in the reconstruction of Iraq. In the first phase of the reconstruction under General Garner, they were allowed to participate. Then when Paul Bremer took over the reconstruction, he started a de-Ba'athification program. What was his explanation for wanting to ask, you know, to get Ba'athists out of the reconstruction program?
De-Ba'athification, again, was a key platform plank of the Iraqi National Congress. That the basic assumption was that the Ba'athists were so had done so much harm to the country that there was no way that anybody who was in the top 40,000 Ba'athist technocrats, bureaucrats that had anything to do with Saddam's government simply couldn't stay. They had to go. This was a controversial proposal because there were other Iraqis who said, you know, we need a smooth transition. Many of these people were Ba'athists out of need, not because of belief, not because they were committed to Saddam, but simply because they were people who had chosen to get by. So they said, look, we've got to keep some of these people in place. And Garner was going about with that approach. And when Garner was let go and Bremer came in, Bremer basically removed some 30 to 40,000 people from ever working again in any government position. And these people then had nothing to do. Some people will say that these people then become a major problem for the occupation in that they support the so-called resistance.
We've talked about the importance of Ahmet Çalabi's role in making the case to go to war. How controversial he was, you know, how the Pentagon supported him and the State Department distrusted him. What is the role of Ahmet Çalabi now in the new Iraq?
Well, Ahmet Çalabi is one of the members of the Iraqi Governing Council that was appointed by the coalition, by the administrator, Paul Bremer. So he's one of the 25. It's now 24 because of the assassination attempt, the successful assassination of one of the members. So he's one of 24. He no longer enjoys the kind of backing that he would have hoped. Bremer realizes that it's going to be a long and slow process of building a democracy. On the other hand, there still is pressure coming out of the vice president's office and some of the civilians in the Pentagon who would like to see a quicker turnover of power. Ambassador Bremer seems to understand, from what I can gather from talking to him, that it's going to take time to build institutions that will stand up a real democracy. You don't want to rush into an election before everyone that counts has a chance to organize politically and put forward candidates.
You went into your Frontline documentary, Truth, War, and Consequences, with a lot of questions. What are some of the questions you come away with now that you've completed it?
That's a good question. I think I have a lot of the same questions. I still have the questions about the intelligence. It's not my contention that the administration was lying, as many believe. I think they believed that. They interpreted the intelligence. Again, the intelligence was spotty. So I still have questions about how they were able to take such spotty evidence and turn it into the kind of, as I say, clear and unambiguous message that they did. I have questions about why we listened so much to the rosy scenario, we will be greeted as liberators, sweets and flowers, when there was lots of evidence on the table that this wasn't be the case. So I those are still the big questions.
Martin Smith, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Martin Smith, his Frontline report, Truth, War, and Consequences, will be shown tonight on most PBS stations. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader, available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com, from the University of Alabama School of Law, Shaping the Next Generation, on the web at alabamalawschool.com, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of My Losing Season, a memoir of life, love, and basketball by Pat Conroy, author of The Prince of Tides. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actress Sarah Polley. In her new film, My Life Without Me, she plays a young wife and mother who's just found out she's dying of cancer, but she keeps it a secret from her husband and children. Polley's other films include Exotica, The Sweet Hereafter, and Go.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sarah Polley, is a veteran actress, although she's only 24. She started acting professionally at the age of 6. Her movies include Exotica, The Claim, Go, and The Sweet Hereafter, for which she won the Boston Society of Film Critics Award for Best Supporting Actress. Polley stars in the new film, My Life Without Me, with Mark Ruffalo, Deborah Harry, and Amanda Plummer. Polley plays a young wife and mother who lives in a trailer with her husband and 2 daughters in the backyard of her mother's house. She works nights as a janitor at a university. Early in the film, she learns she's dying of cancer, but she doesn't want to cast a shadow over her family, so she keeps the news a secret from them. After making that decision, she has her second meeting with her doctor.
So you didn't come last week?
There didn't seem to be a lot of point.
I have to give you a further scan. And a fuller biopsy.
Okay, no, I'm sorry. I don't want any of those things, okay? I'm sorry, I need to feel like I've got some control. So I don't want any more tests if they're not going to save me. Okay, I don't want to be here, I don't want to die here. I will not have the only thing my kids remember about me be a hospital ward.
That's why you're here, man.
It's this package, I want you to look after it for me.
I don't know. What is it?
I've recorded birthday messages for both of my daughters for every birthday till they're 18.
And you want me to give these to them? Well, why don't you ask your husband?
Because Don would, you know, he'd lose them, or maybe he'd give them to them next year, maybe the year after that, I don't know. Or maybe he'd give them to them all at once. You know, they wouldn't understand a thing if he did that, so... Can you just tell me I'll do it, please?
Sarah Polley, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
What is it in your character's personality that you think explains why she doesn't want to tell her husband and her children that she's dying?
Well, I had it explained to me by a Japanese journalist who said that she's a very Eastern character. I think that she does actually the exact right thing in the context of her life. I don't know that... keeping your death or your dying a secret is the right thing for many people to do in the context of their lives. But for her, I think it really is the greatest gift that she can give her kids and her husband to save them the kind of trips to the hospital and the memory of her dying. And as someone who lost, you know, I lost my mother to cancer when I was very young, I really understand that instinct to do that. It's not necessarily, again, what I would recommend people do in this situation, but I think in the context of her life where she really is the most responsible, competent person in her life, she really is giving them a gift and she really is doing the right thing.
Your mother died of cancer when you were 11, is that right?
Yeah.
How did she tell you that she was sick?
Well, it's an interesting thing and probably another reason why I was really attracted to this material. You know, I don't think she ever really admitted or knew that she was going to die, although objectively, sort of, you know, in retrospect, it would have been very clear to anyone that it was terminal, you know, 2.5 years before she died. But she had a doctor who was actually a really good friend of hers who was also in denial. And no one really ever admitted she was going to die until, like, the day before it happened. So she was someone who didn't get a chance to do all the things she wanted to do before she died for her kids or for herself. And so there's something sort of oddly therapeutic about playing a part where someone dies so well and so gracefully and accepts it so fully and then has the chance to kind of do something about it.
How long was she sick? How long?
2.5 years.
So you watched her get sicker and sicker.
Yeah.
You know, one of the premises of My Life Without Me is that the character, when she finds out that she's dying, your character, makes a list of all the things that she wants to do before she dies, including, you know, finding a new wife for her husband, mm-hmm. sending birthday messages for every year until they reach 18 for both of her daughters. Did you ever find anything like that your mother had? A list of, like, things that she wanted to accomplish before she died?
No, because I think, unfortunately, she never had the moment of realizing she was going to die. And I think that's why this was so interesting to me, because I think she's someone who would have made that list and would have been very practical and very pragmatic and had the strength to do all those things. She just didn't have the chance.
Lots of people have fantasies about what they would do, how they would live, if they were told that they only had a few days or weeks or months.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever have fantasies like that?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I don't know that I ever really managed to make my list. You know, I actually found that while I was making this film, it was important for me to not compare what I would do to what the character would do, because I inevitably came into conflict with the character. I think she's 10 times stronger and nobler and braver than I'll ever be. So, you know, moments where she's doing things for other people, I'm not sure that, you know, having discovered what I would do would make it easier to play her in some way. So I don't know. I mean, I honestly think what I would do would make a really boring movie. It's like the least cinematic list of all time. Like, I think it just involves sort of drinking tea on a couch and reading the paper and, you know, hanging out with friends. So it's really not a good movie.
I think it's interesting what you said, that you didn't want to examine what you would do too much because it would bring you into conflict with the character. One technique of acting is to kind of go deep into yourself and find those similarities between you and the character, and to find the emotional moment in your life that most resonates with that moment. And it's interesting that you would say that sometimes doesn't work, that there's a big difference and you have to go with the character and not yourself.
For me, I have no objection to actors sort of taking things personally, making those personal connections. I think it can really work for some people. For me, I find my acting is always a lot better when those connections are subconscious. And I think, you know, what drew me to the character and to the piece, you know, the connections are all there, and I have a lifetime of experience that kind of, you know, helped me go there. To make those connections consciously, for me, it feels like you're somehow exploiting your own life in a way that I'm sort of uncomfortable with. Again, I pass no judgment on actors who do that. But for me, I always find the best work I do comes out of really trying to see the world through someone else's eyes and not through my own.
Now, you started acting when you were like 5 or 6, so you obviously hadn't studied the method yet or anything.
No.
You hadn't been to like drama school. So what advice were you given about what to draw on and how to get into a character when you were just a child?
Well, it really varied. And, you know, there are directors who know what they're doing with kids, and there are a lot of directors who don't know what they're doing with kids. And, you know, ultimately, I think it's an incredibly damaging environment for any child to be in, no matter how much they want to or no matter how much their parents want them to be in it. You know, the worst examples were 2 weeks after my mother died. I was on a series, and they wrote in a scene where I cry about my mother dying because they knew they'd get a great performance out of me. So, you know, that's where, you know, I probably formed my whole, you know, style of not making those connections personally, because for me, you know, that began as a very sort of exploitative tactic from someone else. So I sort of felt like that experience in a way got robbed from me by someone for a crappy TV show, which was kind of a drag.
That sounds horrible.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
So did you weep a lot in that scene because the emotions were still raw?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the problem then becomes, and, you know, I kind of have a theory about child actors. When you see a great performance by a child actor, you know, the ones that we can think of, I've done a lot of research into it, and you know, 9 times out of 10, when there is something written, sort of biographical information about that child, the great child performances, the great crying scenes come from kids who were either abused physically or sexually or had a parent die young. And so it sort of calls into question, like, are we watching a great actor in, you know, in this child actor, or are we watching somebody's grief that is being sort of a forced catharsis that then prevents them from experiencing it in a natural way, maybe when they're older and more mature and ready to do that? So I sort of have this ongoing debate in my head about whether or not, you know, I should even go and see films that have kids in it when they're crying. So I think crying scenes with kids should be avoided at all costs.
My guest is actress Sarah Polley. She's starring in the new film My Life Without Me. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Sarah Polley is my guest, and she's starring in the new movie, My Life Without Me. Now, I know your father is an actor, Michael Polley.
Yeah.
And your late mother was a casting director.
Mm-hmm.
Did you learn about acting from watching TV or from watching them go to work?
Probably both. My mother was an actor, too, at certain points in her life. And, you know, I think that they probably taught me that it was something, you know, worthwhile in some sense. Like I constantly in my life feel ambiguous about whether or not this is a worthwhile thing to do with your life. I always want to feel like I'm contributing something or changing the world in some way, and is acting really the most direct way to do that. And they were people who were very sort of progressive and very socially conscious, and felt like this was, in a small indirect way, a way to contribute or change the world in some way. So in that sense, I learned its worth and its merit. You know, they were stage actors and very different style of acting than I have. I mean, my dad, you know, the kind of actor he was on stage is something I could never do or never even aspire to do. He's sort of like the kind of person who can own a room and light up a room. And I'm the kind of person who's, you know, I'm very introspective. And I think I only really work on film in that way. Like, he can go out to an audience and I can only work in environments where the audience comes to me. So it's a very different kind of craft, I think.
It was interesting you should say that, because with the exception of Go, the roles that I've seen you in are really introspective roles, and you often have some kind of like secret that you're keeping, or something just like really private and personal. And when I watch you on screen, I'm always thinking, what is she thinking? What has gone on? Why is she doing this? It is a very kind of introverted presence that you often have.
Yeah, and it's something that that I really love doing. I've always really loved playing characters with secrets. I feel like there's so many more layers to play with there, and scenes where you come into contact with another actor become so much more sort of dynamic when there's something you're withholding. I find even roles where there isn't a secret, I try to create one, just because I think the possibilities then are endless, and you can surprise yourself more often, which I think is the greatest joy of being an actor, is when you do something that you didn't expect. So I do love playing those kinds of parts. I'm sort of experimenting now with doing other things where I'm a little less introspective and a little braver in some sense. So I don't know. I mean, maybe I'll mostly focus on doing the kinds of roles I've done, but I'd sort of like to be able to know that I could do the other if I felt like it.
Something else I wanted to ask you about your childhood. I read about this. Tell me if it's true that you had an operation for scoliosis, curvature of the spine, when you were young.
Yeah, when I was 15, I had 2 Harrington rods put in my back.
Wow. So you have them now?
Yeah, I've got a pound of steel on my back that goes off every time I go through an airport metal detector.
Oh, what a great time for that!
Yeah, no, it's really
remind me not to travel with you.
It's really something. There's a lot of having to hike up my shirt and show like 50 people that there's a scar.
Oh, how bizarre.
No, it's really bizarre.
So does that limit like the exercises and stuff you can do?
No, it's actually, it's one of those, it just worked really well for me, this surgery. It was, you know, it's a 10-hour major surgery on your spinal cord, and somehow my life is completely normal. There's very few things I can't do. I mean, I don't do anything high impact and I don't move pianos, but beyond that, I experience little to no pain.
And were you very troubled, like, with pain before the operation?
A bit. It's more discomfort. It's more just sort of a long-term thing because, I was walking strangely. My spine was clearly curved. Like, I had a bit of a Quasimodo stance when I was about 15. So, ultimately, it could have, you know, collapsed in my organs and my lungs and that kind of thing. So, it was sort of more of a preventative thing because scoliosis generally doesn't get better. It either stays the same or gets worse.
Right, right.
It was about a 60-degree curve I had, so it was pretty important to have it done.
Right, wow. So, you know, I want to figure out how you got from the childhood roles that you did on screen, which were like Disney roles. Mm-hmm. Actually, before we get to the roles that you've done as an adult, just kind of tick off for us some of the childhood roles.
I did, you know, I was the lead in a series called Road to Avonlea, which I think in the States was called Avonlea, that ran for many years on the Disney Channel. I was in The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. I was in a series called Ramona. And then a bunch of sort of like TV movies and things like that.
Okay. Now, as a mature teenager and young adult, you started doing films like Adam Egoyan's movies. He's an independent Canadian film director. And the film Exotica, in which you co-starred. This is a film about incest and mysterious sexual urges and lots of secrets, and really, it's a terrific film. So that's a pretty complex movie. And then Also with Adam Egoyan, you made The Sweet Hereafter, in which you play a student who survives a bus crash and is left crippled mm-hmm. and unable to walk. And there's more about secrets in that movie also.
Mm-hmm.
But both of those movies are movies in which a lot is implied and not said, and the viewer has to kind of figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the movie Guinevere, he played opposite the actor Stephen Ray, who's maybe mm-hmm. most famous for his role in The Crying Game. And, you know, he plays like an older artist who's in his 50s, and you're, you know, a young girl about to enter college, and he becomes your mentor and lover, and that's something he always has in his life. He has a string of, like, young girls who's, who he's mentored and been lovers with, and it's a very complex, unpredictable relationship. Anyways, these are complicated films. So how did you find them?
I would say that working with Adam Egoyan is really what made me fall in love with acting and realize it was something that I wanted to do into my adulthood. I feel like I learned about acting from working in his films. And, you know, working with an actor like Ian Holm was a really pivotal experience for me in The Sweet Hereafter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, I was sort of trained there. I sort of think of those films as my acting school, Exotica and The Sweet Hereafter. And so the rest kind of came naturally out of that.
I'm glad to hear that Adam Egoyan made you really want to stay an actress, because I like his film so much. But tell me what it was about working with him that made you feel more strongly about acting.
There's just such a thoughtfulness to the process of making his films, and there's such intellect behind what he does. And, you know, up to then I'd done kids shows, you know. It wasn't something that I thought of as a serious thing to do with your life. I thought, you know, I would quit acting, you know, when I was 15 or 16, and, you know, I wanted to go to university, and I wanted to get a degree in political science, and I wanted to run for office. And I thought, like, this is how you change the world. And I sort of felt like, you know, what he taught me is there's this way of saying something important that's either directly or indirectly political through films you're making, or saying something, you know, sort of that has some kind of human importance, and that it's a way of being an activist in a strange sense. And sometimes it's really clear what that means, and sometimes it's not. But there's a kind of faith he gave me in films and their ability to change our minds and affect the way we live that really excited me.
And what about the British actor Ian Holm, who you worked with in The Sweet Hereafter?
Well, that was just, I think working with him and doing scenes with him, it's this moment when you're working with certain actors who are so focused on what they're doing and so focused on what the other actor is doing that you realize there are certain moments that it's sort of worth living a life for, where you have a moment of pure, unmitigated communication with another human being. And sometimes I feel like those moments were only uninhibited enough to have those moments when there's the artifice of a film set around us, that when we are shooting a film, we can actually look into each other's eyes and affect what the other person is saying, affect how the other person is reacting, and change what they're going to do. And there's something so intoxicating about that. And I experienced that for the first time with him. And, you know, if I would look a certain way in a scene, he would stop what he was saying and look to where I was looking. And that sense of being so attuned to what another person is doing, I just felt like what a useful exercise in terms of, you know, learning to be a human being in this world.
I love how you described what Ian Holm was doing, how he was responding to your every move and probably your every thought. It's so like not the egocentric actor who's just thinking like, how do I look and how do I get the attention focused on me?
No, it's an amazing thing. And to sort of work with someone who's such a sort of brilliant technical actor and so sort of incredible, who's willing to kind of give it all up based on what the other actor is doing, even if that actor is like a 17-year-old, totally inexperienced young girl, it's a pretty astonishing thing to see, you know.
My guest is actress Sarah Polley. She's starring in the new film My Life Without Me. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sarah Polley, and she's starring in the new movie My Life Without Me. She's also starred in Exotica, The Sweet Hereafter, Go, and Guinevere. You had apparently been very close to getting a role in Almost Famous, the role that Kate Hudson played of the groupie Penny Lane, and you decided it wasn't for you. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
And why did you decide that? Because that's an example of a career-making role.
You know, there's a lot of sort of complicated and disparate reasons for that. It's a decision that I'll always be really happy I made. I think it's a really great film, and I think Kate did an amazing job, and I think that I had an instinct that I was not the right person for that part, and so I pulled myself out of it. And when I saw the film, I felt really legitimized because I feel that she was the right person for that part, and she brought a depth to that part that I couldn't see. And I don't know, the truth is, like, you know, the last 5 years of my life, I guess since I made that decision, I've worked only on films that I love doing. I have a comfortable life. Like, I can't see a way of complaining or having regrets. And the truth is, like, my worst nightmare would be to have Kate Hudson's life right now. You know, I have this, like, sort of wonderfully anonymous life combined with being able to do films that I love. So, you know, it was a sort of life-forming decision in a way, but it's always one that I'll be grateful that I had a clear enough head to make at the time.
You don't seem to be into the glamour part of acting.
I don't really know what glamour is. I think that's my problem. Like, I read this thing in The Art of Seeing by John Berger where he says glamour is the state of being envied. And that to me is so kind of abstract and so difficult to want. I mean, in a way, I understand why people want tons of money and I understand why people want this and want that. But fame is something so elusive and it doesn't really mean anything except that a whole bunch of people that you've never met know your name. And it just seems like a sort of frightening thing to aspire to. It just sort of seems so difficult to pin down.
Now, you said that you really wanted to change the world and that you thought when you were young that you'd drop out of acting and study political science and, you know, run for office. You actually dropped out of high school and not with the intention of acting, but with the intention of becoming more political.
Yeah, I had a couple of years where I quit acting and I quit school and I was just really involved in organizing politically. There was a conservative government that was elected in the province I live in Ontario, and they immediately set about, cutting welfare to the point where people couldn't really live anymore. Cutting funding for the arts, trying to dismantle our public health care system in order to clear the way for a two-tiered health care system. And it was something where I saw, like, the things that I love about Canada and the reason I'm so proud to live there sort of coming apart and disintegrating before our eyes. And so it was sort of a sense of urgency where I just thought, I don't think I can sleep at night unless this is what I'm working towards every day, is stopping these people. So I was involved with a lot of anti-poverty organizations, and I'm involved still with the Toronto Health Coalition in trying to sort of preserve public health care because it's been working really well. And it's not going to anymore once they sort of manufacture a crisis big enough that they can justify bringing in some private,
now
some private coverage.
Now, you had a couple of teeth knocked out during a demonstration?
Yeah, when I was 16. It was one of the first really large protests against the Conservative government in Ontario. And, you know, at that time in Ontario, police violence to that degree was kind of unheard of, and they sort of brought the riot cops in and we got trapped between sort of a huge, you know, row of horses and about five lines of riot cops and riot gear, and I'd been standing on the front lines talking to this cop for about half an hour. There was just a standoff, and, you know, he was saying, you know, when I was your age, I was doing the same thing as you are right now. We had this really amazing talk, and I sort of thought naively, I was 16, you know, this is amazing, you know, we can form these bonds across the barricades. And the next thing you know, they had the sort of call to push us off, and I had two teeth knocked out and had my stomach battered in by the same guy who I had made this really great connection with. So, yeah, it was definitely a wake-up call.
So this is when you were 16?
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
So this was after the scoliosis operation?
Yeah.
Gee, so, I mean, that's a bad time to be getting battered around.
Yeah,
like
I guess
that.
So. Thanks for your concern. I don't think anyone's ever made that connection before.
So but you were okay?
Yeah, it was fine. It was fine. I mean, the sad thing again about that, and again, where my sort of sense of not knowing whether or not it's a great thing to talk about these things in the press is, you know, I was standing up there with, you know, 9 or 10 welfare moms who were beaten up 8 times as badly as I was, who went to the hospital and had stitches. Nobody wrote anything about them. They were never on the radio talking about it. And it's been totally forgotten. And, you know, this is, I mean, 8 years later, and I'm still talking about getting my teeth knocked out.
Right,
so there's a certain sense of, like, an imbalance to things and playing into something that you fundamentally despise about society, that actors have all this airtime and people who need it don't, that you know, I guess you just have to keep struggling with. I don't know that you can ever resolve it.
You live in Toronto, which is obviously, you know, far from Hollywood. I'm sure that probably helps you in keeping your life as the life that you want it to be. But do you ever feel too distant from roles, or too distant from the people making the decisions about roles?
You know, I've been really lucky, and I don't think it's really affected my career in a negative way. I mean, I'm sure there are things I don't know about that may have happened if I had been stationed in LA, but I'm really happy in Toronto. I have a really great life, and I've been able to continue to do the films I want to do. So there really is no reason for me to move. And, you know, I have a community there, and I have family there, and my life is there. So it's never been something that's really been an issue for me, whether or not to move.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
Sarah Polley stars in the new film, My Life Without Me. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dutton Books, publisher of La Faire, a comedy of manners and culture clash by Diane Johnson, author of Le Divorce. An excerpt is available at authordianejohnson.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Clint Eastwood's new movie, Mystic River, is adapted from the best-selling novel of the same name. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the author, Dennis Lehane. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.